Upton Sinclair, socialist, health food advocate, and feminist.
He had just a very great appreciation for women. He was a very, we would say, non-sexist man. You know, he didn't see women in terms of their appearance or their availability as sexual objects or any of that. He really respected them as equals and as activists, if that's what they were, and writers.
That's Lauren Coodley. We talk with her about her new biography of Upton Sinclair. Then poet Maxine Cumin died February 6th. We remember Cumin with my 2006 interview with her and a 2007 conversation about Cumin with Jean Bram and Barry Mosier. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Had Upton Sinclair not written a single book after The Jungle, he would still be famous. But Sinclair was only 25 when he wrote The Jungle, and over the next 65 years he wrote nearly 80 more books and won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction. He was also a filmmaker, labor activist, women's rights advocate, political candidate, and healthy diet pioneer. My guest, Lauren Coodley's new biography, Upton Sinclair, California Socialist, Celebrity Intellectual, underscores his place in American history as a fighter for social justice, whose concerns are as relevant today as they were then. Historian Lauren Coodley is the editor of The Land of Orange Groves and Jails, Upton Sinclair's California, and the author of three books on local California history, as well as California, a Multicultural Documentary History. Well, Lauren Coodley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Upton Sinclair is best known for his 1906 book, The Jungle. Tell us about that book and the tremendous impact that it had.
I think everybody knows that the legislation that was supposed to make our food safe was passed as a result of the uproar following the publication of The Jungle. So that was the big impact that it had. The Food and Drug Administration was formed, and meat inspections were initiated. Upton Sinclair never thought any of that was enough, and he had to fight very hard, even against Theodore Roosevelt, to get those changes. You know, in the popular narrative, Theodore Roosevelt, you know, did everything, but that's not really the case. He was kind of forced into it by this book. And people were concerned about the condition of their food, which wasn't really his aim in writing the book. But the ironic outcome was that food safety, to the degree that we have food safety, we have it because of Upton Sinclair's book.
I'm not sure all our listeners, even if they've heard of The Jungle, many of them have not read it. Tell us a little bit about the book and how it came about, and you know, we'll go on from there to explore Sinclair's life more in depth.
So Upton Sinclair, I feel like I need to start at the beginning, which is that he grew up in Baltimore and New York, and he was very poor. His father was an alcoholic. He was very troubled both by health problems and by trying to figure out why his life was the way it was. He turned to, you know, poetry, to Shakespeare, to Shelley, to all kinds of sources, to religion, to try to understand the misery in his life. And eventually he found socialism when he was about 20, and it completely changed his life. It was as a socialist that he wrote The Jungle. He read about a very agonizing strike that was unsuccessful by the slaughterhouse workers in about 1903-04. In a magazine called Appeal to Reason, which was, you know, very common magazine, kind of like, I guess, the Village Voice used to be. Not a mainstream magazine, but a widely read magazine. And he wrote a letter of encouragement to the strikers, which they published in that magazine. And then the editor said to him, why don't you write a series of articles about the slaughterhouse? Why don't we'll pay for you to go live in Chicago? And, you know, you can figure out how to get the information. Just go there, stay there long enough to get the information, write some articles for us. So the book began as a series for, you know, what we might call an underground newspaper or a left-wing newspaper. He went and lived in Chicago in workers' houses, and he essentially invented undercover journalism by more or less posing as a worker and going everywhere they did. So he got his material. He went back to New Jersey and wrote the book. And it was serialized, and it was quite a sensation. And then a couple of publishers started bidding for it. One of them backed out. Another one wanted it, but insisted that a lot of changes be made. It was a battle to get it published, but it was published, and it was an instant bestseller in 1906.
One of the interesting things about the book is that even though it's more than 100 years old, the topic of meat safety is still very relevant today, and that's a thread that you found throughout your book, Lauren Coodley.
Yes. Some people say that the Republicans in Congress are trying to erase the 20th century. They're really trying to gut the progressive reforms in which government protected the individual against what the corporations would do to them. So whether we're talking about public health or education or many other causes that Upton Sinclair was interested in have sort of come back today as issues. The resilience or the survival of labor unions, civil liberties, these are issues that I think might have been a kind of a settled thing in the mid-60s when he died. But unfortunately, they've now come back as very real problems. Food safety and with the GMO battle, I understand it's heating up in New York. So that's, you know, a big issue that I think he thought was settled that wasn't.
You say something in the book that his purpose was to understand how society was run, by whom, and for whom. In fact, you sum him up in two words, social justice. And before you talked about his family upbringing, tell us a little bit more about how he grew up and how his early years, how his childhood kind of made him ripe for that revelation that he got when he found out about socialism.
He was born to a family, both who were had been members of the Confederacy in Virginia. He was born in Baltimore, but their families had come from Virginia. His father was a whiskey salesman. His mother was the daughter of a railroad baron. His mother's relatives still had a considerable amount of money. His father's did not. Because of his father's alcoholism, they lived in boarding houses. They were frequently evicted from. There were bed bugs and all kinds of horrors. They all lived in one room. He slept at the end of his parents' bed. And frequently, when they ran out of money to live on, he and his mother would go stay with the wealthy relatives in Baltimore. And he got to see what upper-class life was like in Baltimore, which was described by Thorsten Veblen and Edith Wharton. They both wrote about these very, very upper-class families, and he got to see how they lived, and then he got smashed back into this very poverty-stricken life. So I feel that he was more equipped to understand the contradictions of wealth and poverty than most people are.
And his father, as you say, was an alcoholic. His mom was very involved in the temperance movement.
Yes.
And I think that temperance movement is seen today as kind of the butt of jokes, is seen as some kind of, you know, ridiculous prudery. But you have a very different take on it. Talk about temperance and Upton Sinclair's advocacy of it.
Yeah. Well, as I say in the book, scholars of temperance are beginning to have been for, I would say, quite a while, maybe 10, 15 years, critiquing that, you know, popular image of the lady with the hatchet. What it was a very powerful social movement. It was the most powerful women's social movement of the 19th century. Women felt that if they could control alcohol, they could mitigate domestic violence and have some income stability. So women were more interested in temperance than they were in suffrage. It might be easy to understand why, because it seemed to have an immediate effect on their domestic and family lives, not to mention the amount of violence that alcohol could engender. So if you study the history of American women, you see that there was a very, very powerful movement that lasted for decades and decades that aimed at having alcohol be prohibited. And there were marches and rallies, and Upton Sinclair's mother participated and brought him to those rallies.
And do you think that that also had an impact on his feminist ideas? I mean, I was surprised to learn that he, back in the early years of the 20th century, was a feminist. And what does that mean, actually?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up. as you probably realized, I'm the only woman that's ever written a biography of him. And I'm also the only person who has taught history of women to have written his biography. The two combined allowed me to understand Sinclair differently than has been done before, because I recognize the names of all the women that he was writing letters to and that he was friends with, women who should be better known, but because of the shocking absence of women from history books, you know, are still relatively unknown. And you probably saw that at the end of my book, I have a appendix that lists a bibliography of those women, just to kind of help the reader learn more about them, because they're really some of the most interesting women of the 20th century. Sinclair was part of a movement of men in New York, I would say radical men, who called themselves feminists. He was not the only one. He was probably the one that lived the longest, because many of his radical friends had problems with alcohol. But Floyd Dell was a man who would have called himself a feminist, and he wrote the first biography of Upton Sinclair in 1927. He also labeled Upton Sinclair a feminist, just like I did. But in between, no biographies have ever discussed this.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Lauren Coodley about her biography of Upton Sinclair, out from the University of Nebraska Press.
He both lived feminism in his life as well as in his writings. Start with the first. What were his ideas about domestic labor? How did his feminism inform his second marriage? His first marriage, you know, that he entered into when he was fairly young, ended in divorce, but his second marriage lasted for a very, very long time.
Yeah, 50 years. So he had just a very great appreciation for women. He was a very, we would say, non-sexist man. You know, he didn't see women in terms of their appearance or their availability as sexual objects or any of that. He really respected them as equals and as activists, if that's what they were, and writers. He didn't cheat on his wife, starting with his second marriage in 1912. He believed in monogamy. He felt that that was the most rational way to live, along with some of his experiments in diet. And he just extended the hand of friendship to so many women who desperately needed a male friend in the struggles that they were waging, whether it was Alice Stone Blackwell, who was working for women's suffrage, as both her parents had, whether it was Edith Summers Kelly, who was writing this great proletarian novel about California farm life, whether it was Helen Keller, Agnes Smedley, Vera Brittain. Some of these names will be familiar. To me, the most notable thing that he did was right after he published The Jungle, he took all the money, $30,000, that he made and plunged it into a utopian colony, an experiment in group living, that was based on the theories of Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Now, I've taught quite a bit of history, and I've never seen a man found a utopian settlement based on a feminist woman's theories, especially about housework and childcare.
And what were those?
She wrote that it was a shame for every woman to be slaving in her own kitchen if communal kitchens would allow a whole bunch of women not to be involved in housework. So she favored communal kitchens, and she favored communal childcare, so that sometimes women got time off from watching children and could engage in what she would call world work or world service. She was one of the first people to advocate kindergartens, for example. And she was a great thinker and sociologist who wrote many, many books in the early part of the 20th century.
And so he founded this utopian community, Helican Hall. What was it like?
Well, everybody who's lived there called it heaven. He loved it, and the people who lived there always had very fond memories of it. It was burned down in a mysterious arson fire within a year. So what it was like was, if you can imagine, sort of a summer camp where there's a place where the children go and are cared for and have activities. The adults can go to their rooms and write and then get together for the evening meal. The children's put on theater things for the adults. Sometimes the adults had book conversations. It was very staid. There wasn't, you know, any wife swapping or drugs. It was a very a community of intellectuals and idealists.
He was a feminist. He was attacked for being unmanly. He was lampooned as some kind of effete elitist or, you know, effete man. Talk a little bit about the attacks on him and ones that, you know, were very personal attacks on that questioned his masculinity.
Well, as early as Theodore Roosevelt, you know, the term muckraker was coined by Roosevelt as a derogatory term. It means people who just want to get in the mud. You know, Roosevelt had a lot of contempt for men like Upton Sinclair. Roosevelt, you know, promoted the red-blooded, virile man of action, you know, riding on a horse, killing a bear, was his idea of what men should be doing. So he started making fun of what he called the mollycoddle, the namby-pamby, the crank, the reformer. He really developed a rhetoric of contempt, which got continued by other people that were more, that even opposed Upton Sinclair more fully. For instance, the publisher of the LA Times, Otis Chandler, who made a big speech about, you know, this perverted masculinity and how only an audience of women would ever want to listen to Upton Sinclair. I think that's in the beginning. I have that quote at the beginning of chapter 4 in my book. So this language persisted throughout his life. I think he pretty much ignored it and laughed it off. It didn't bother him at all because he understood these were kind of the rhetoric of his political enemies. But what I found a little disappointing, shall we say, is that his first biographer in 1975 also used that language. And in fact, other biographers, you know, kind of made fun of him. They've called him a prude and a blue blood and, you know, they're just kind of derogatory terms, like a not quite manly man.
It kind of puts me in mind of, there was a book about the white women who, there is a book about the white women who supported the Harlem Renaissance, as Carla Kaplan's book.
I've read about it, yeah.
Yeah, where women who crossed the color line were seen as insane, as, you know, nymphomaniacs. And here, a man who crosses the gender line in the sense of having friends with women is attacked as unmanly.
You know, that is a such perceptive point, because I would call him, you know, that they saw him as like a gender traitor. And, you know, certainly those women were seen as race traitors. So it is exactly analogous. That's an excellent point.
You mentioned before his diets, that probably added the fuel to the fire of the way he was seen by red meat manly men. Talk about his interest in health and in diets.
Well, that's why, as you mentioned, Francesca, I feel like he's eerily relevant. I mean, I feel like today everybody gets it about diet. Everybody gets it about food politics. And so we can interpret and understand Upton Sinclair much better than even maybe people in the 70s could. Because who was talking about diet in the 70s? Or who understood the need for everyone to, you know, be thinking about what was in their food? Upton Sinclair was really part of what was the popular health movement, which had been a feminist movement that had advocated a variety of reforms since the 19th century. Barbara Ehrenreich and Deirdre English wrote about it, you know, magnificently in all of their analyses. They've written a number of books about this popular health movement. But it was designed to be in opposition to traditional medicine. It was designed to counter the AMA with more reliance on herbs, on folk remedies, on, you know, looking at diet, which, as you still know, the AMA still doesn't really study nutrition. So they, you know, this movement had a number of well-known adherents, like Kellogg, who founded the Battle Creek Sanitarium, and Mr. Graham, who founded Graham Crackers. It was known to intellectuals and celebrities, but regular people didn't know how to eat. And so Upton Sinclair, what I admire so much is that he always wanted to make sure that ordinary people got the benefit of this kind of information. So he wrote several books about how to eat better, you know, based on his own experiments with diet and health. The Book of Life was the one in 1920. That's the last book he wrote. And the first one was Our Health and How We Want It, or Good Health and How We Want It.
Now, he was incredibly prolific, writer, many, many novels. We only have a chance to really touch on a few. I wanted to ask you about Oil. I, you know, hadn't heard of it until reading your book, Lauren Coodley. Tell us about Oil. This is obviously another issue that we're very involved with today.
You know, he felt that Oil was one of his greatest books, and it was seen, even when it came out, as one of the great California novels. It's more than ironic that it's almost completely forgotten or unknown, although it's been brought back in recent editions with commentary by, you know, contemporary scholars. So Upton Sinclair's classic hero was a young man of wealth, much like perhaps, you know, one of his cousins, who was a wealthy young man who had a, you know, very good education, who then gets out in the world and starts to realize the real politic of who owns what and who profits from it, and has to kind of examine his conscience and decide what to do. So that's what it's really about. It's about an oil man's son. And D.H. Lawrence praised it as, you know, a very brilliant novel in the way that it examines the businessman. The father is written with so much sympathy, even though Sinclair is basically skewering him. But it's been praised as such a brilliant portrait. You know, when the book was revived here in the 90s and the early 2000s, you know, the guy was compared to Dick Cheney, that it was that kind of personality. And then his son, who starts to see things differently and starts to question, and, you know, it's all set right at the beginning of the oil boom in California, and it's great descriptions of what California looked like before it got transformed by highways. Really a beautiful, brilliant, well-done book, included in the collection of California classics, always cited as one of the great California novels.
We're talking with Lauren Coodley about her biography of Upton Sinclair. It's Upton Sinclair, California socialist, celebrity intellectual. He ran for governor in 1933, and he had a very unique kind of campaign. He actually called it EPIC, End Poverty in California. He won the primary to the surprise of many. Tell us about this campaign.
Well, I used to say it was like Howard Dean. In 2004, I used to say, well, it was just like Howard Dean's campaign. But now I can say it was like Bill de Blasio. You know, whenever you think of some candidate who's completely captured the public imagination and who has some very progressive ideas that seem to have wide support. So now I would say he was, you know, the Bill de Blasio of that era. And there was a huge infrastructure created by citizens who wanted to be part of this. They called it the EPIC movement, End Poverty in California. There were theater pieces, there were songs, there were rodeos, there were parachutists, there were quilting bees. There was a huge and very, very meaningful movement that people were part of, which was, you know, like the civil rights or the feminist movement. It was the most significant thing in these people's lives. And it did end up changing California, although he lost within 2 years. The Democrats, for the very first time, began getting elected to state office in California.
And you think that's because of the success of the EPIC campaign?
Yes, I do. I think that other EPIC candidates won, and they did a huge voter registration, so a lot of new people were voting. And, yeah, it really changed California.
Now, he won the primary. Why did he lose the election?
There was an organized campaign against him. It's been actually brilliantly described in Greg Mitchell's book, Campaign of the Century. He devoted a whole 500-page book to document how one of the studios, MGM, allied with the Growers Association and the LA Times and a number of other newspapers to do essentially a smear campaign against him and to create fake newsreels that they inserted into theaters, and to quote from characters in his book that they put on the cover of the LA Times as though he had said them, but they were things that his character said. For example, they claimed that he was for free love, even though, as I've indicated, he'd already given all of that up by, you know, 1912, and this was 1934.
He had a huge campaign against him. He also, in spite of being famous and a best-selling author, for many years he lost out on honors because of his politics. So he was a pretty controversial figure, I guess you'd say.
Well, he didn't get the Nobel Prize, and he didn't get the Pulitzer Prize until 1944, 42. He should have gotten them sooner. I don't think he felt particularly like he lost out on prizes. I think that he felt that he had been very effective. He really wanted to be part of Hollywood. He felt that film was a way to really reach people, so he was successful in getting a couple of his movies made into films. That made him really happy. And he, you know, helped found the ACLU. That's one of his proudest achievements. So I don't think that he was short of honors during his life or success.
It's evident that his legacy is kind of all around us, from food safety to, you know, many of the concerns that we deal with today and our knowledge of them. Was there anything that really surprised you as you did the research on this book, Lauren Coodley?
It's the thing about his friendships with women, because, you know, that wasn't in any biography. So I was actually at the Lilly Library, where all his papers are, and I started seeing all these letters from women that I, you know, had been teaching about, and I asked for copies of them. In those days, in the 90s, you know, there wasn't scanning, there wasn't, you know, I had to get a Xerox, and I took them home, and I kept them in, you know, in my files. And I never honestly thought I'd get the chance to write this book, much less use these letters. So when I actually decided to write the book, I had the letters right in my hand. It was a very, very exciting moment for me. And that's one of my chief messages, is that, you know, women sometimes feel that there are no male allies, or there didn't used to be male allies. And I think we have to reclaim that history of the fact that there have been some very important male allies for us. If we don't know that, then, you know, it's hard to understand the present or the future.
Well, Lauren Coodley, it's just been a delight to have you talk with us today about Upton Sinclair. Your biography of him is Upton Sinclair, California Socialist, Celebrity Intellectual. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Lauren Coodley's biography of Upton Sinclair at writersvoice.net. Next up, we remember poet Maxine Cumin. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Poet Maxine Cumin died on February 6th at her beloved farm in New Hampshire at the age of 88. In 2006, she spoke with Writer's Voice about her poetry, her horses, and her love and concern for the natural world. We'll play that interview for you later. But first, we air a clip from our 2007 interview with author Jean Bram and illustrator Barry Mosier. Maxine Cumin is one of four New England poets they write about in their book, The Light Within the Light. Here's a clip from my interview with them. I asked Jean Bram to describe the farm where Cumin lived.
She lives outside of Warner, New Hampshire. The last about mile and a half, I would say, is straight up on a corduroy road, dirt road. And the farm opens in increments. There's a barn on the left-hand side, which is about three levels. There's a beautiful old 1800s red farmhouse on the right-hand side. If you were to go probably another half mile straight up, you would come to a pond that she and her husband built. And then if you were to go another mile and a half straight up, there's this gorgeous riding arena that she and Victor carved out of the granite that she calls the Elysian Field.
And that's her husband, Victor?
Yes.
Maxine Cumin was a very good friend of her fellow poet Anne Sexton, and she was also the last person to see Sexton before the latter killed herself. Jean Bram told us about their relationship.
Could you say first, for those of our listeners who may not know who Anne Sexton is, who she was and what this friendship was about?
She was a very dramatic, very beautiful, somewhat flamboyant, but also married woman and mother living in Newton, Massachusetts at the same time that Cuman and her husband and her three young children were living there. She had a long love affair, unfortunately, with the bottle, and also had psychiatric ups and downs that were treated with a bewildering array of medications. And she used cumin, I think, as a kind of steadying rod. And cumin used her as a kind of inspiration. And they were the first two women, I think I'm right in this, who were given Radcliffe Seminar Fellowships, now called the Bunting Fellowship. And largely, I think, as a consequence of moving with young women artists and writers and journalists, were really at the vanguard of what was then becoming the feminist movement in the arts.
You know, one of the things I particularly like about Cuman's poetry is her mixture of the quotidian and the inner life of the heart.
She is one of those poets, I think, who demonstrates better than others that I can think of the difference between tenor and vehicle, which is to say, there is a particular feature in the metaphor that is literal. And then there's the whole associative richness that goes along with that literal thing.
That's something that really comes up quite a bit in her poem, To Anne Sexton.
That's right.
She was was she, in fact, perhaps the last person to see Sexton alive?
She was the last person.
Why don't you say something about how that happened, and then we'll ask you, Barry, to read the poem.
Well, as I understand it, they met frequently for lunch, and many of Sexton's friends realized that she was on a real downward spiral and were quite alarmed about her behavior. But I think Maxine continued to just be the steady friend, the neighbor who was around the corner. And on that particular morning, Anne Sexton showed up at Cuman's house. They had lunch together, hugged each other, said goodbye, said, see you tomorrow. And Sexton went home and drove her car into the garage and put the door down, left the car running, arranged herself in her mother's fur coat on the front seat, and was not found until the next morning.
Wow. And so then this poem really talks so tellingly about that friendship and Cuman's reaction.
That's right.
To Sexton's death.
Maxine Cuman's poem, How It Is. Shall I say how it is in your clothes? A month after your death, I wear your blue jacket. The dog at the center of my life recognizes you've come to visit. He's ecstatic. In the left pocket, a hole. In the right, a parking ticket delivered up last August on Bay State Road. In my heart, a scatter like milkweed, a flinging from the pods of the soul. My skin presses your old outline. It is hot and dry inside. I think of the last day of your life, old friend, how I would unwind it, paste it together in a different collage, back from the death car idling in the garage, back up the stairs, your praying hands unlaced, reassembling the bites of bread and tuna fish into a ceremony of sandwich, running the home movie backward to a space we could be easy in, a kitchen place with vodka and ice, our words like living meat. Dear friend, you have excited crowds with your example. They swell like wine bags, straining at your seams. I will be years gathering up our words, fishing out letters, snapshots, stains, leaning my ribs against this durable cloth to put on the dumb blue blazer of your death.
Barry Mosier reading Maxine Cuman's poem,
How It Is. I spoke with Jean Bram and Barry Mosher about Cumin in 2007. Maxine Cumin died on February 6th. I spoke with her in 2006 about her book, Jack and Other New Poems. Let's hear that interview now. Now, your most recent book, is Jack your most recent
Jack volume? Is my most recent book, but I'm just completing a manuscript that's coming out next September. It will be called Still to Mow. It's a wonderful quote from John Gardner, who said, "When you look back, there are lots and lots of bales in the field, but when you look ahead, it's all still to mow."
A familiar feeling.
Yes, and it seems to me maybe symbolic as well of my life.
Why is that?
Well, because I, you know, even though I'm now one of the olds, I still feel I have a lot to say. It's all still to mow.
Going back to Jack, which is the latest book, Jack and Other New Poems,
right,
that you've published, the connection here is very, very strongly in this book, as with many of your books, with the animal world.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could read just for us, because I would really love to spend a lot of time during this interview having you read your poetry.
Okay. All right. I have a copy of Jack. What did you want?
Well, what I'd really love is just to start out by telling us, first of all, something about who Jack was.
Uh-huh. Well, I think the poem pretty much says who Jack was, but I can expatiate upon that a little.
Okay.
He came into our lives in a rather strange way. He belonged to a teenager, and he was an only horse on the property, and he kept leaving. That is to say, he found ways to get out, and he would walk down the highway, but he was very careful to stay very close to the edge of the highway, to the next farm. And eventually, she lost interest, and a home was needed for him. And we're usually the repository. When a home is needed, it's usually our home. So that was how he came into our lives, and he was, I have to say this about him, we had a brand new foal, who had been rejected by her mother, and she had to be raised as an orphan foal. And he just became her uncle. He took her everywhere. You could see him out in the pasture, and he would nudge her as if to say, "Come on, kid, it's time to go in and get a drink of water." And then she would obediently follow him in. He was a wonderfully safe horse, but very uncomfortable to ride because he had extremely straight pasterns. And when you posted, you could feel it in your cheekbones. So we didn't really have a lot of use for him, but we loved him and we kept him around, and that's where this poem, this is my guilt poem, Francesca.
Your guilt poem?
My guilt poem. I think everybody has something they feel guilty about forever, and this is my guilt poem. I will now read it. Jack, how pleasant the yellow butter melting on white kernels, the meniscus of red wine that coats the inside of our goblets, where we sit with sturdy friends as old as we are after shucking the garden's last silver queen and setting husks and stalks aside for the horses, the last two of our lives still noble to look upon, our first foal now a bossy mare of 28, which calibrates to 84 in people years, and my chestnut gelding, not exactly a youngster at 22. Every year, the end of summer, lazy and golden, invites grief and regret. Suddenly, it's 1980, winter batters us, winds strike like cruelty out of Dickens. Somehow, we have 7 horses for 6 stalls. One of them, a big-nosed roan gelding, calm as a president's portrait, lives in the rectangle that leads to the stalls. We call it the motel lobby. Wise old campaigner, he dunks his hay in the water bucket to soften it, then visits the others who hang their heads over their Dutch doors. Sometimes he sprawls out flat to nap in his commodious quarters. That spring, in the bustle of grooming and riding and shoeing, I remember I let him go to a neighbor I thought was a friend, and the following fall she sold him down the river. I meant to, but never did go looking for him to buy him back, and now my old guilt is flooding this twilit table. My guilt is ghosting the candles that pale us to skeletons, the ones we must all become in an as yet unspecified order. Oh, Jack, tethered in what rough stall alone, did you remember that one good winter?
Now, you said that that's your guilt poem, and
yes.
I wonder, when you read it, and you must read it quite a lot or be asked to read it, does that guilt come up again?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So it's a painful thing to
read.
Yeah,
I feel very bad about what I failed to do, my sin of omission. I found it very hard to believe that this young woman would do such a thing. You know, I was just incredulous when she told me.
Yeah. And down the river means?
She sold him to some, who knows? Mm-hmm. She sold him to somebody.
Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of gets to one of the questions that I had for you. Your poetry looks full face on some very difficult and painful things. There are the themes in your poetry. I mean, the beautiful connection. The connection to the natural world is one that brings both great joy and great pain, considering the state of the natural world these days.
Right.
And a lot of your poetry, for example, in Nurture, the poem Nurture, as well as in the poetry volume Nurture, you take up the theme of what is going on with the planet, how animals are being destroyed, how species are being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that pains me whenever I read or listen to a report on the radio or something that talks about the death of a species. I feel it viscerally.
Yes, I agree. So do I.
And often it's too painful for me to really remain there. I switch to another channel. I turn to a different page. But when I read the poems in Nurture, I was able to look full face at this through the medium of your poetry. And I wonder if you could talk about that. In what way can poetry enable us to contemplate the horror in a way that doesn't destroy us?
Well, it's a delicate balance between, you know, writing a polemic and writing a poem. How it operates upon the individual, I think it has to operate artistically. In other words, it has to be a good poem. Then it can convey a message. And I've been particularly taken with this kind of, what shall I call it, not quite conflict, but the difficulty of bringing the two together. In the new book, Still to Mow, there are a whole series of torture poems. And my way of handling it was to write in form. One is a villanelle, one is a pantoum. I mean, to use these archaic old forms to talk about entering houses at night, for example, or what you do to the ghost prisoner. That really was a dilemma. I think it exists on any level. Anything that goes beyond the simply lyrical has to engage with the world as it is. And I guess Nurture is one poem that does. There are a lot of others. I'm thinking of With the Caribou. Many of the poems in the volume Nurture do this, but having just found it, I'll be happy to read this poem if you'd like.
I'd love to have you do that, but I also would like to ask you to tell us what a villanelle
are. Oh, come on. Well, the villanelle is an old, old French form, and it's written in three-line stanzas, and the first line and the third line of the first stanza have to get repeated in a certain order. And then the final stanza is four lines. So you have two open lines, and then you have to use your first line and your third line to complete it. So, you know, technically it's a challenge, but for me form is always so liberating. When I have something hard to say, I seem invariably to wander into this difficulty. Now, the pantoum is an old Malaysian form, but again, there's the issue of the repeat. the first, I hope I'm saying this right, the first and third lines of the first quatrain appear as the second and fourth lines of the second quatrain, and so on and so on and so on. It can be as long or as short as you want it to be. But why I, you know, why I do this or why I write sonnets, it's just in my bloodstream. And besides, I'm old, and I grew up on formal poetry, and I love formal poetry. I mean, I love poetry that dares to rhyme and that dares to use meter, but at the same time kind of hides the fact that it's doing this. In other words, I'm not interested in a poem where the rhymes chime and chime and chime. I'm interested in slant rhyme, approximate rhyme, surprising, I hope, surprisingly apt rhymes. But actually, the poem Nurture is written in free verse.
I'd love to have you read that poem then.
Okay. Nurture. From a documentary on marsupials, I learned that a pillowcase makes a fine substitute pouch for an orphaned kangaroo. I am drawn to such dramas of animal rescue. They are warm in the throat. I suffer, the critic proclaims, from an overabundance of maternal genes. Bring me your fallen fledgling, your bummer lamb. Lead the abused, the starvelings, into my barn. Advise the hunted deer to leap into my corn. And had there been a wild child, filthy and fierce as a ferret, he is called in one 19th century account, a wild child to love, it is safe to assume, given my fireside inked with paw prints, there would have been room. Think of the language we two, same and not same, might have constructed from sign, scratch, grimace, grunt, vowel, laughter, our first noun, and our long verb, howl.
Maxine Cumin reading from her most recent collection of poems, Jack and Other New Poems. You know what I found, aside from the charmingness of that poem, as well as, you know, the shades of Emma Lazarus and the inscription on the Statue of Liberty,
right,
was how, yes, it is free verse, but that at the end...
Well, it rhymes at the end.
It rhymes at the end,
yeah.
And that's a kind of very powerful combination,
mm-hmm,
to end with that rhyme.
I'm glad you liked that.
I did like it.
Yeah.
And there's another poem that I'd love it if you would read it, and that relates actually to the themes of your family and also of a terrible accident that you suffered several years ago and then wrote a memoir about.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you first tell us what happened, and then I'd love it if you could read the poem, The Sunday Phone Call.
That's in Jack, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Oh, I'm glad you like that. What happened? This happened in 1998. In brief, I went to a meeting, the monthly meeting of what we called, we had a group called Wheel Runners. These were people who were all into driving horses. And because the ring was otherwise being used, we did this in an open field. And someone had brought two young Arabians, and one of them jumped out over the Dutch door and ran onto the field and ran right into my horse. It was just chaotic, and he just lost it. This is a horse I had driven. I had driven him, I think, almost 1,000 miles, and he was a superb driving horse. Anyway, he bolted, and eventually I was thrown out of the carriage. And then as he came back up the field, he swerved to avoid stepping on me, and instead he pulled the carriage across my body. And this was a 350-pound marathon carriage. My life was saved by an emergency room nurse who was also a driving friend, who was just there that day observing, and she ran out on the field, and she wouldn't let anybody turn me over. If they turned me over, I wouldn't be talking to you. They airlifted me to Dartmouth, which is a primary care hospital in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And I was 3 weeks in the intensive care, and then, I don't know, a couple more weeks in the neurological unit, and then I was in rehab. It was very, very hard on my family, and it was awfully hard on me. Oh, coming back from that accident, I'm really still coming back from it. I mean, I have chronic neck and shoulder pain and arm pain, and I'm always going to have those. And I, you know, you do learn to live with these things. It's kind of amazing.
And you stayed for months inside this halo.
Yes, I
as
had
you call
this
it.
Awful halo screwed into my skull. And that accounts for the fact that I'm tipped to one side, because that was the position I was put in. So, you know, my head tilts. But that's okay. But here I am, and
it's more to hoe. I mean, it's
yes,
more to mow.
And more to hoe. Exactly. And this poem is, it just happened, this poem did. And the best line in it just came to me. I mean, this was a given poem. I didn't really write it as much as I did record it. And I don't have a lot of trust in people saying that. I don't say it very often, but once in a while, a poem just comes, and it feels to me as though the muse has relented and sent it down, and I take it very gratefully. Most of my poems I work very hard for, and I push them through, zillions of revisions, and I don't let them loose until I feel really comfortable with them, and that's probably a few months after I've written them. But this was just something immediate. It's called The Sunday Phone Call. Drab December, sleet falling, dogs loosely fisted in torpor, horses nose down in hay. It's the hour, years ago, I used to call my parents, or they'd call me. The phone rings. Idly, empty of expectation, I answer. It's my father's voice. Pop, I say, you're dead. Don't you remember that final heart attack, Dallas, just before Kennedy was shot? Time means nothing here, kiddo. He's jolly, expansive. You can wait eons for an open line. Time gets used up, but comes back, you know, like ping pong. Ping pong, the table in the attic, my father, shirt sleeves rolled, the wet stub of a burnt-out cigarette stuck to his lower lip as he murdered each one of my three older brothers, and me yearning under the eaves, waiting for my turn. You sound just like yourself, I say. I am myself, goddammit. Anyway, what's this about an accident? How did you hear about it? I read it somewhere. Broke your neck, etc. He says this vaguely, his shorthand way of keeping feelings at bay. You mean you read my memoir? Did you know you're in it? Didn't read that part. No reason to stir things up. Now I'm indignant. But I almost died. Didn't I tell you never buy land on a hill? It's worthless. What's an educated dame like you doing messing with horses? Messing with horses is for punks. Then, a little softer, I see you two have put a lot of work into that hunk of real estate. Thanks. Thanks for even noticing. We love it here. We'll never sell. Like hell you won't. You will. Pop, I say, tearing up. Let's not fight for once. My only papa, when do I get to see you? A long pause. Then, coughing his cigarette cough, Pupchen, he says, I may be dead, but I'm not clairvoyant. Behave yourself. The line clicks off.
And what's your favorite line in that poem?
I may be dead, but I'm not clairvoyant.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that poem kind of leads me to another, and again, related to your family and to horses, and that's Women and Horses. You also take up the theme of your family's history and the Holocaust,
yes,
and connecting it, I think, really to the ongoing Holocaust of today, both animal and human.
Right.
So in this poem, there is this wonderful melding of, again, looking full-faced on the horror, but pulling out that love and that joyousness that is also in life. So I wonder if you could read that as well.
Yes, it's just going to take me 1 second to find it. Okay. Women and Horses. And then it has a little epigraph. After Auschwitz, to write a poem is barbaric. Theodor Adorno. after Auschwitz, after 10 of my father's kin, the ones who stayed, starved, then were gassed in the camps. After Vietnam, after Korea, Kuwait, Somalia, Haiti, Afghanistan, after the towers. This late in the life of our haplessly orbiting world, let us celebrate whatever scraps the muse, that naked child, can pluck from the still smoldering dumps. If there's a lyre around, strike it. A body, stand back, give it air. Let us have sparrows laying their eggs in bluebird boxes. Let us have bluebirds insouciantly nesting elsewhere. Lend us navel-bared teens, eyebrow and nose-ringed prodigies, crumbling breakfast bagels over dog-eared and jelly-smeared texts. Allow the able body among us to have steamy sex. Let there be fat old lady in flowering tent dresses at bridge tables, howling babies in dirty diapers, and babies serenely at rest. War and détente will go on, détente and renewed tearings asunder. We can never break free from the dark and degrading past. Let us see life again, nevertheless, in the words of Isaac Babel, as a meadow over which women and horses wander.
Thank you so much. That's a wonderful poem. And yet, why did you put that first, that quote by Theodora?
The little quote from Adorno.
I mean, I can understand the connection, but then how do you go on? I mean, what do you think about that quote?
Well, I think this was a man who had suffered greatly. But you can't, I mean, it's absurd to say that to write poetry is barbaric after the Holocaust. All the more reason to write poetry, as far as I'm concerned. If you don't bear witness, what are you? It's up to us to go on and to bear witness and to write about it.
Well, in the last couple of minutes that we have left, I wonder if I could ask you to read a poem of your choosing, whether it be from Jack or anything else, or something new that you might want to share with us.
Oh, yes, I'd love to do that. Hold on one sec. I'm going to read a little sonnet from the book that's coming. Okay, believe it or not, this is a sonnet. It's called Xochi's Tale, and Xochi is spelled X-O-C-H-I, and tale is T-A-L-E. Xochi's Tale. Is it my fault I'm part rat terrier, part the kind of dog who lives in a lady's lap? I didn't ask to be bottom mutt in the pack that runs untamed through the twisted, trash-strewn streets in Xochi Apulco. I didn't ask to be plucked up by a pair of gringos. First, they took away my manhood. No more sweet reek of bitches, no hot pursuits, no garbage rot. When they packed up to go back to the USA, I thought they'd cry, then dump me out. But no, macho mestizo, my entry papers say, who dines in style and sleeps the sleep of kings, ought dream no more of his rowdy half-starved days. I dwell in heaven, but without the wings.
That's great.
That is our little Xochi.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Maxine Kuman, for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
That was poet Maxine Kuman talking with me in 2006. She died on February 6th. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.